And when was Burroughs born? Is he 1914? He's just a few years younger than McLuhan, isn't he? He's almost the same generation.
Let's see. I should say that near the beginning of this book here.
Did Burroughs ever meet or encounter Peter Beter's work?
Not that I know of, but I wouldn't be surprised if he did, because he was always into that, all kinds of things like that, from 20 years before. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's an advanced notion to be.
When was he born?
Sorry, 1914, February 5th.
Right, and he died in 1997. So, yeah, he's McLuhan's generation.
I was just going to say it's pretty ahead of his time, like you said, to be trying to clear the air for Geisen on the subject of extraterrestrials and suggesting that a human involvement in that or source.
Mm-hmm. Right, and he also is a very smart junkie. You know, I used to know Dean Latimer, and he told me he was a great writer for the East Philly Jother. You know, he worked for Walter Boward, and Carol and I would occasionally meet him in New York through the years. He ended up writing for Screw magazine in the 70s. But he told me that the junkies who you hear about that are OD'd or get ridiculous and homeless, they're not smart junkies. He says there are many people who can be junkies and they keep their cool, like himself. They would use heroin. What?
Like practicing doctors?
Yeah, like doctors. And actually, you can survive as a junkie and or as a heroin user and live a regular life if you are detached in some way. Do it as a yoga. But, you know, it's the people who have problems, emotional problems or something, they always ruin everything. You know, they're pink. So this terrible image of junk as a deadly thing is not true among the smart users of it.
Yeah, it's more of a crackhead kind of a thing that, you know, that kind of a helpless, there's almost no way to use it and still be functional,
right.
That kind of image has gotten grafted onto.
And it seems Burroughs was like that. So he was a smart junkie or a smart heroin user.
It's funny, too, about him, you know, outlasting people like, I mean, people like Ginsberg and Leary, he only outlived them by a year or two, but still, that, and he was older than them to begin with. It's funny because I'm sure he would have credited some of that to sitting in a orgone accumulator, but he also had this idea that because so many times in his life he had been addicted to opiates of whatever kind and then kicked it and then re-addicted and kicked it again and gotten back on and back off, that had enabled him to live longer because he basically was forcing his cells to kind of regenerate and not totally stagnate into the usual aging process. That it's funny, you don't think of repeated relapsing on heroin as being something that'll help you live longer, but it seemed to work for him.
Right. Now, when it just suddenly occurred to me, he was always a menacing guy. Like when he was with the Beatniks, he was the guy. They forced him to be the godfather of the group. He was older, but because he was kind of antisocial and went around with an accountant's suit on, he just didn't fit into the hipness of what the Beatniks were supposed to be, and he was menacing. I know that I do that among certain people. So the second last conversation with Patti Smith was at a gallery of her paintings. This would be 2004. Yeah, 2004. And so I get talking to her about her friendship with Burroughs, who she loved, and she was at the funeral. So I started asking questions about the funeral and this and that, and very quickly I turned into William Burroughs. She says, I'm not sure what your motives are in asking me these questions. And I wasn't obviously, invasive. I was just being polite. But the point is, they could pick it up. They could pick up this fucking guy. It's dangerous. This guy is not one of us. He's a spy, which is what everybody used to say about Burroughs. So I did Burroughs to Patti Smith, and she couldn't take it, and she walked away. She wouldn't. She says, I think you're using me to find out stuff about Burroughs and how he died. So, and it wasn't really
for some dark reason.
Yeah, there's, you know, when you actually are penetrating actually antisocial mind that can see through everything, people pick up on it, man. They know that you ain't normal or you're a threat. I got that even in my own fucking family.
So could you just go into that phrase a little bit, that when you use heroin, you're putting on the entire universe?
Yes.
When you use LSD?
LSD, you see great imagery. It's like the mind's eye and maybe synesthesia, a lot of visual and acoustic stimulus. I may have played it during BobFest. The Evergreens describe technically, basically what LSD does is just confuses the triggering of your normal sensory processing. So if you've got your organ, your tactile organ, which is not a sense, orchestrating the ear, the eye, the touch, the smell, and all that stuff coming in, it makes coherent consciousness. LSD just mixes up all that signaling. So you start, the brain gets confused and it starts, the tactility tries to keep organizing things, and you have a great, you know, interesting trip because everything's all mixed up. So that's basically a visual phenomenon. But when you take heroin, you get this rush that makes you feel, I guess, ecstatic or bigger than the universe, and you're not hallucinating. You're not seeing anything. You just got this incredible feeling, and that's putting on the whole universe. That's not a consumer's visual banquet of imagery. You get it?
So
yeah.
I'm saying. Yeah. The LSD thing, would you say, is sort of a synesthesia chaos?
Yes, but it's consumerist. It's not the producer. When you get into the electric age, you become the producer and maker of your own spaces. So you make yourself bigger than the universe, and you process anything that comes in as tinier than you or doesn't bother you. You know, that's the thing about heroin. It makes the people say that you don't care about anything, right? You feel kind of completed. Well, you don't get that with LSD. You're distracted by the imagery.
Yeah, you're more likely to be constantly anxious.
Yeah. Yeah, you get a bliss with the heroin. So it was very interesting how McLuhan, as far as we know, he never did heroin, but he figured out what it was by reading reports that you put on the whole universe, which is what you're actually doing with electric media. It's like LSD was a replay of the movie world of the 30s and 40s, but heroin was the satellite world where you swallowed the whole planet. The whole universe, and you put it on as your content, invisible content.
There's something to be said with that, too, musically, especially in the context of the 60s, that the psychedelic music and psychedelic rock was generally very, you know, very busy, lots of stuff going on and kind of chaotic things happening, whereas Lou Reed's heroin was a more kind of anticipated the later drone music, you know,
yeah.
Created just droning thing.
They weren't trying to entertain. They were making non-music.
Yeah.
It's like you could be happy with a drone, with a repeated beat or something. Whereas the LSD guys, the prog rockers, were in doing Baroque spirals of imagery.
Yeah.
The psychedelic rock.
The drone music, a lot of really fantastic drone music was made around the turn of the millennium, and kind of one of the best aspects of the electronic music revolution really was the drone music that came out, and a lot of that was more aimed at a kind of a psychedelic audience, as well as probably other drugs or a heroin kind of an audience.
Ecstasy.
Yeah. Although, ecstasy, you know, has that amphetamine thing that kind of worked more with the beat, but still kind of a droning trance beat.
Right. So, did we answer your question, Bart?
Yeah.
Did you know that you had such junkie experts in your midst?
No, it's surprising to hear such knowledge coming from folks who aren't maybe as experienced with those drugs, you know, as...
Well, I just think it really shows you McLuhan's genius that he could write. I have a great review of Houston and Masters, the varieties of psychedelic experience. That was the book in the mid-60s that you know, studied, first presented reports on LSD users. And McLuhan's incredible how he reviews it and his knowing. And he said, it looks like in this global theater, synesthesia global theater, that I have to wait till Dr. Dean finishes her noise. her chips, eating chips. Okay, so he says that the psychedelics are the new art form. He says theater, music, painting, all the Gutenberg arts are obsolete. We don't have a way to be in any environment in the synesthesic global theater of the 60s. But he said probably psychedelics are the best anti-environment to the way to have an anti-environment to this global massage. And how's that for a guy who goes to mass every day and teaches among priests and wears a suit and does not hang out with beatniks on the weekend? So that's pretty knowing, yeah. Pretty understanding of what psychedelics are. I mean, he writes this. But 4 years later, he writes in Counterblast that he blasts, he doesn't bless LSD anymore, he blasts it for being chemical warfare. So it got carried away by the late 60s, and it got popularized by Owsley and everybody else who was distributing it. Became even what Tim Leary didn't. Tim Leary didn't agree with that level. They accused him of popularizing. He didn't agree with the being on the street, and neither did McLuhan. And remember, McLuhan inspired Leary to come up with the phrase, turn on, tune in, drop out. Here's McLuhan, like any great thinker of any phase, he's influencing all the arts and new sciences and all over the place.
Mm. Yeah, and picking up on the...
Thing, sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, you go ahead. It's I'm just repeating a thought that Bob shared.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, right,
Brian.
I was just going to say about the turn on, tune in, drop out. When people are very anti-Leary, they and kind of coming up with a cartoonish negative view of his effect, they kind of tend to see it. They kind of tend to misremember his slogan as if it was just turn on, drop out.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you can once you know the story that he came up with, that the idea to come up with a slogan was McLuhan's idea, then you can really kind of notice the somewhat McLuhan-y media-ish influence of the idea of tune in, because
yeah.
It's like a technological metaphor. It's not just turn on the TV set and to whatever static and bash your brain with that. You know, it's no tune in.
Yeah.
Like the tune in part is the most important part of the three.
Yeah. You look at the figure ground. So the do you guys know the story that McLuhan was on an airplane and he was talking to somebody about going to Simon Fraser University in British Columbia to pick up his LLD, Doctor of Laws or something, LLD. So he gets off the plane and the customs officer stops him and says, okay, where is it? And McLuhan says, what? He says, where's the LSD? We heard you talking about it on the plane. He says, no, that was an LLD. But they actually were going to bust him because they thought he had was picking up his LSD or had picked up his LSD. So that's a funny thing. And Barry Nevitt used to say that he and Marshall would sit around in the late 60s saying, should we take some LSD? What do you think, Barry? And Barry suggested he not because he had the longest surgery in the brain, you know, in history in 67. So this would be talking 68, 69. He thought, no, I don't think your brain can take it. Now, Barry may have been wrong, but he won the day there. He prevented McLuhan or persuaded him not to do the LSD, at least to the degree we know. You know, maybe there was some secret stuff going on. But the... No, you have to realize this guy is in the middle of every scene all over the place. I mean, René Thom, there's different great thinkers in so-called great thinkers in modern physics who were influenced by McLuhan. You know, like I think it's René Thom came up with catastrophe theory. He got that by trying to process McLuhan. And this is what Don Thiel's great manuscript is about, the ecology of sense. And the word sense has many meanings, you know, sensuousness, sensuality, sensory sense and making sense, and he's put together all the arts and sciences and how they were influenced by James Joyce. Now, there's a big thing. You guys don't even hear about James Joyce in school. And he's suppressed now because the lesbian leftist feminists have kicked out Joyce out of the university. Can you imagine that? Can't even get taught about, can't even hear about him in university, just like they kicked out McLuhan. That's where the chemical body women really blew it. And here's everything that you ever heard of was influenced by James, by Phineas Wake.
Thank you.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear someone who's in university to share what curriculum they have right now.
Well, Robert Guffey, who we started off talking about, his conspiracy book where he tries to figure out me, he says in some, maybe the interview with Jerry Fialka, that he's a teacher of English, of fiction, at Long Beach College. I think he's just an assistant professor, but he's got a gig there. They're not allowed to teach fiction anymore.
What?
Yeah, that's what he says.
What the hell?
Brian's having a breakthrough here. Okay, what's the figure ground here? Well, it's because we're such in a fictional world, the Matrix, right? Virtual reality, this is my instant theory when I heard it. So there's something about we already live too much in fiction because the average literate teacher thinks that the virtual reality is not real. They don't see it's part of our bodies. And so, okay, if we're living in fiction and the kids are just, you know, iPhoning and texting fiction, we don't need any more fiction. We got to get nonfiction in there. And I don't know how they do that.
Or,
but
or fiction has become nonfiction. Nonfiction has become malleable, so it's...
Well, nonfiction, fiction used to be what they taught, and they're not allowed to teach it anymore. So they got to teach something else, which is not fiction. So I don't know.
It's an English or literature program, though, right? So I mean,
right.
Are they just studying like how to write? You know,
well, you know, they're fading out English. I mean, I used to talk to Don Thiel about this because he was, you know,
yeah,
president of university. He was up on it. He's the one who would tell me about these crazy developments. They don't even call it English anymore. It's like, I mean, not every university, but the major trend is it's, I don't know, interdisciplinary cultural studies or something. There's so much political correctness involved, you can't even call it English.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know the fine details of it. We had someone here who was a university student, went through it recently, but it's way different from when you went to university, Bart, if you ever did.
I did, but I was an art major.
You were an art major.
I was. I did all my reading on my own on the side.
I mean, you were doing art, graphic design and stuff.
Yeah,
well, you guys had ruined the Department of English because you're creating the virtual reality.
I got
you killed Joyce.
Myself.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's pretty bad.
Killed Joyce.
Yeah, killed Phineas Wake, man.
Well, I'm...
So,
what?
Suitably chastised?
I'm bringing it back. I was trying to say I'm
okay, yeah. How you can do that? You can't even get your fucking partner to listen to any of it.
Yeah. That's a whole other story.
Oh, okay. You can't be a prophet in your own town. Okay, use that alibi.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All you people can't convert your family to Iandom. Yeah, you can't be a prophet in your own hometown. Think of it that way.
I can't even convert my wife. What the heck?
Yeah. Yeah, she knows you. She knows you too well.
Yeah.
Wait, remember the local people in Jerusalem or whatever, or Nazareth, wherever Jesus came up, they go, what? What do you mean? The carpenter's son? He's healing all these people? And he goes, fucking nuts, that the carpenter's son? So your wife would say, what, that graphic designer is altering the ecology?
Right.
Healed? No way. At least her relatives would say that about you.
Yeah. Well, she's saying it, and so I'm leaving it be. I'm at least wise enough to know that.
Yeah, Brian.
Oh yeah, sorry. I was walking down the street with a tissue sticking out of my nose because it's cold up here, and someone stopped their car and said, "You all right, man? You got a nosebleed?"
There's the Canadians for you. They're very considerate. I mean, who in the States would stop for a guy with a Kleenex dangling out of their nose? Not going to happen.
Kind of odd.
Yeah. Uh-oh, Gene's here. Gene probably will come in with some ridiculous question. Have you got a ridiculous question, Gene? Now, you
actually,
guys,
Robert
go
Guffey,
ahead.
Bob.
Yeah.
You said that Robert Guffey wrote, tried to figure you out and wrote a conspiracy.
Yeah, this book. That's what Brian. You probably missed it. There's a. It's. What's the title of the book, Brian?
Cryptoscatology, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form.
Yeah, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form. And that's pretty big, lofty thinking. And he, I'm all through the book, and he's trying to figure me out. And he talks about me at the end, doesn't he? Doesn't he kind of try to pigeonhole me as part of his conclusion?
Yeah, in some earlier chapters, he just cites a quote here or there to help understand something from you. But in the last... or second last chapter, it's a story about figuring out a particular case that he had a personal connection to that he involves you in the story of you consulting the Evergreens.
On their FBI buddy, their FBI buddy who got killed.
Yeah, and then at the end when he's kind of epiloguing the whole thing and talking about the landscape that he's laid out of archetypal characters, he... calls you the trickster.
Yeah, I was the role model, and he's not going to emphasize me too blatantly because he doesn't want to, because he's pissed off at me in some way. You'd have to read between the lines and notice it is about me.
Yeah, well, I mean the whole you being the most McLuhan being the most relevant thing to conspiracy theory is sort of your insight that you've kind of delivered.
And they never could believe whether I was or not involved with the Kennedy assassination or the Secret Council 10, all that. Definitely, the idea of conspiracy theory as art form, one could judge by listening to me and Bob Marshall. That's what. I mean, several people at CKM did tell me that. They said, Bob Marshall, he's doing theater, isn't he? And
yeah.
they would sort of notice. But it's because we would never identify with any particular story we're talking about. We would do the whole buffet of possible views of something. We weren't there with an axe to grind. And that was new in the 80s. People were still literary and still had points of view and thought you were supposed to have a point of view, and promote it. They thought if you talked about something, you were for it. And McLuhan was the revolutionary on that. He was the first guy to say, people think that if I talk about something, I'm for it. I'm absolutely against it if I talk about something.
Or I don't know what I was thinking until I said it or whatever else.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what I think until I say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what were you going to say about Robert Guffey, Gene?
Well, I noticed I'm looking at a website that has a summary of Robert Guffey. I noticed that book was just published in 2012, and he also is an author of a collection of novellas entitled Spies and Saucers with a 2014 publishing date.
That'd be a new book, yep.
Oh.
Yeah, no, but Robert has written fiction for years. It's published here.
Yeah, I went to another, as I was looking him up, I went to another site that appears to be like a rating site that his students are rating him in these categories. And it sounds like a lot of them say he's hilarious and they really enjoy his classes. So I'm really curious what he might be saying about you in class.
No, he uses my stuff. That's all that Guffey has. He uses stuff all the time in articles. I would inspire him stories that he would write. I got a lot of his early stories. I mean, he's the one who figured out that The Matrix is about me. So that started him thinking. And then he was creative, but he found out a whole bunch of new information once he... met me, and then, of course, he found out the McLuhan stuff, which in his science fiction writing world, nobody knew about. So he got a unique position there, and he's got a good imagination, and he sort of tweaks my stuff. I mean, we used to talk, and he would talk to me about what he said, quoting me with his students, what would happen in class when he would say my stuff. And usually he got not much of a response, but that's... 10 years ago. Maybe the kids are more, they like it now.
Yeah, he's getting very high ratings. as a teacher. So that was
I definitely recommend his article about the Matrix being about Bob. That was the first thing. I was a Church of the Subgenius fan, and then followed a link with Bob's name on it about Bob, which I assumed it was about Church of Subgenius because his name was Bob Dobbs. And the first thing I read there was Guffey's article about the Matrix, and was hooked. And then, you know, went to read Bob's articles that he wrote.
Yeah. Now you what was the last words?
Just saying, I definitely recommend that, Guffey's Matrix article.
Right, and part two is really important. I chart out, it's called Death of the Matrix, and that's got charts and everything that I gave Guffey. But the, what is it called? Oh, yeah, so you get, so the Church Subgenius either meant this or they were joking, but they said that Robert Guffey was me. They thought no one would write about Bob, so Bob obviously wrote this article about himself, and it's right in the word guff, because, remember, guff means, you know, fake stuff.
Yep.
It's a lot of guff.
Yep.
It's like saying bullshit. So they thought the clue was right in the name, Robert Guffey. They didn't believe he was a real guy. And then we find out that the guff is a major theme with Ion. So, you know, Bob Guffey, it's pretty auspicious, his name, for being the only guy who did promote me. The only guy who did.
And was the Matrix sort of what kicked off the Xenocrony meme for you?
No, I just the Xenocrony first for me was the Blues Brothers. When Nelson Thal, like sometime in the mid-'80s, he said he watched the Blues Brothers. He actually knew them when they filmed in Toronto. And Dan Aykroyd's parents were good friends of McLuhan. Found that out at some point. But he was watching the old Blues Brothers movie, and he said, they dance like you. So I looked at it, and I said, yeah, they're dancing like me. And that's where I probably was all inflated, because I was on the radio getting media inflation. So I thought, well, maybe I'm reflecting something. And I think that was the beginning. And then Twin Peaks came out in 1990, and I didn't watch it in the spring. But then in the summer, when they did the replay, I decided to watch it, and then I was amazed at, like, from the opening line in Twin Peaks, just like, I think Cooper goes, Dale Cooper, the FBI guy, goes, what is the connection between Marilyn Monroe and the assassination of JFK? He says something like that, which were major themes with me and Bob Marshall. So that, it began with that, and other than the Blue Velvet in 86 seemed to have a house like Garrett's house. So, but it was Twin Peaks that really started to me notice something going on. And that's where my chart begins. My chart is from 60 to 90, and it's about the after image from 1990 to 2020 of Lockdown Bob Rule. Well, I discovered in 1990 when Twin Peaks started to happen that there was the after image of me. That's where it began. And then just got worse and worse and worse and more fun till now. It happens every other day.
Yeah.
Look at this Stang thing. You know, this Stang goes to Germany. I go to Germany. He has to go to Germany. And, you know, the point about the big joke that comes from Ian is JW a medium? No, he's a large. And JW does not channel entities, but he allows himself to engage in preposterous realities that can occupy him or be around him. And that's what Ion says we are. Ion is this large, huge thing that JW allows to be around him. So you have this whole thing about the large, and that's who Stang talks about meeting, this mashup artist called the large. I mean,
yeah.
You can't get it closer than that. And they're in Germany right a week after me, and they're talking about the museums, and it's all like the B-level of reality there in Germany, whereas I got the A-level.
Yeah.
And they always perceive they got the A-level, and I got the B-level. Right, Brian? They always flip it.
And I know it's a small side note was on the chat board, your name has a 161 by it when you're typing on the chat board, and that's how old Stang said he was.
That's right. He's even doing exaggerated. I've never heard him say that before, but he's imitating me to the degree people think I exaggerate my age. Yeah, he did it right there, but that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Brian got knocked off, his phone disconnected or something. I always bring him in through Flash. I guess he succumbed. And so Brian's not here. So all you people who didn't want to talk to him, you can talk now to somebody else. Let me just give you a warning. It's a good chance Ian will not be showing up tonight. So you guys are going to be on the spot about what you're going to do to make this an interesting program. You don't have Ion to beat up today.
All right,
what's
so we're figuring tonight.
What'd you say? Not you, Bart,
what's
the other voice.
What's Ion up to?
I can't make it tonight. He can't make. So here's what Ion said. Said he can't make it tonight, and it could be a little bit of a warning to you losers. He says, Bob, have a discussion about how they could do better questioning. How can they start using this resource that they have so stupidly botched in using? Ian asked me to begin a discussion. And Roxana, if she's still here, did you make a video about that, Roxana? Is that the new YouTube, which I haven't looked at yet? No response from Roxana. So, I don't know. Anybody watch her YouTube, the new one she's got? Because we did record something last night about what Ian had said. Basically, Ian, one of the things Ian said is the people, the Ionettes say, are trying to ask questions that they think would interest Ion. And that's not the way to do it. You've got to make up shit. You got to say any words possible, any ridiculous topic, especially in stuff you're – bring up stuff you're not interested in. That should open it up.
Well, then what's the point of writing questions down if we're not – just write it down even if we're interested or not, or if we're not.
No, no. You should be getting questions all week long and writing them down.
Yeah.
Like I heard that you and Ginny formed a lot of questions a couple of weeks ago when you were on. I didn't hear you ask any of them last week.
Yeah, I was on last week as long as I could. You unmuted people, but I was talking. You couldn't hear. So by the time I think I got around to a point where I could get on, I just dropped out.
We had you muted by accident?
Yeah, but I wasn't going to – I mean, by the time that I probably could have interjected, I just had dropped out. But, no, my approach has been more to just engage the words or whatever topic is there at the moment that I'm on, that Ion's on, when I can engage. And I have fun doing it that way because I don't have – I have less of a compulsion or – to really drill down and get answers to things. I'm more eased up on that, so I'm just playing with the words as the topics as they arise. I did write down a series of questions too, so I'm not playing one side or the other, completely. But
what are you saying?
Well, I'm just saying I enjoy playing spontaneously with whatever topics being bandied around.
Yeah.
But I have written down questions since you brought up the subject two or three shows ago. You have been hammering that point home. So,
yeah,
Ginny and I did have a lively discussion a couple of Wednesdays ago, and I did write down some stuff from that and additional stuff from listening to the last couple of shows. I took notes.
Well, we got I think Allison's here. I mean, her phone call's here. I mean, Allison and Sheila and maybe Deb come up with questions every time they do their gagas. And I don't know if they write them down, but they're never saying it. So Allison, if you're here, defend yourself. Why don't you even speak when Ion's here? Why aren't you here when Ion's here? See, like she's late. She won't even talk now. It's so ridiculous. We got many people here, and nobody's saying anything. Not even Ginny's not saying anything.
Do you have everybody muted, or are they unmuted?
No, they're all – they've been unmuted for half an hour.
Yeah. You definitely have driven the point home about writing questions down and engaging Ion when they're here. I think last show they did much better. There was a lot more engagement going on. I think people got the message.
Well, a few people. You got Roxana and Susanna. Roxana and Susanna are pretty good, and Bert – oh, Bert is incredible. Matter of fact, we always have to wait till Bert shows up. Then we get something going on, So
right,
I think Bert's pumping
right.
for another couple hours. But the I just think you guys are losing a big opportunity, and here's Ion's not here tonight.
Hi, Bob.
Yeah, I recognize that voice. That's Roseanne, who should have asked last week. You were here last week and didn't say a word.
It's not Roseanne. It's
oh,
Kate.
Who's this?
Hi.
Oh, Kate the Kid. Kate the Kid. Well,
she's
yeah.
Great.
You're too young to ask anything. You know, you just giggle. You don't even know what's going on. You're
making
sure you're here.
It's fun to listen. I'm enjoying listening anyway.
Well, that's okay.
Since Ian's not here, Bob.
What?
I was going to say, since Ion's not here, can I ask you one or two of the questions that I was going to ask Ion?
Yeah, but my answers are fraudulent, you know, compared to Ion.
I know. I'll just test them on you.
Yeah.
All right, let's see here. Well, that's a Bible question there. All right, maybe I can ask you, about Coldplay?
So you can ask anything.
Okay. Ion said something about Coldplay actually going way back to a cash flow show, and something to the effect that the subject was money and how ridiculous it was, and Ion said you've got to go back to the old Star Trek episodes where they had the machines on the ship where you could just if you wanted a hot cup of hot chocolate, it would just make that for you, and money never entered the conversation. So it was implied that that was one of the functions of Coldplay, or not that specifically, but it would be something similar to that. Is that just an analogy for the sake of?
Okay, I don't know if I got you. What is the what are you saying?
Well,
I don't know. Money? Will there be no money in the Coldfusion?
No money because there was no money on Star Trek. It was a ridiculous notion because they had what they wanted. They would just go to the device and they would just. You know, they'd punch a button or they'd say hot chocolate and it would make hot chocolate. So I was wanting to know if that would be a function of Coldplay, if that's what Ion was pointing out, that it could make a cup of hot chocolate, or if it was just saying that it basically would just obsolesce money.
Yeah. I mean, money is obsolesce now. It's not a viable medium, doesn't control everything, but it sort of has a life, I don't know, for buying ice cream or something, you know,
right.
For vocal stuff. I don't know, I've talked about that so many thousand times, I have nothing more to say about
right.
it. I just
right.
say, we're the new currency, we're the,
right.
Ion's the new currency, and we're going to make it. McLuhan wrote about the substitutability of everything into everything else. Is coming for the consumers. Where you see that in that, what's the movie Congress, where the actress is having a midlife crisis and about her career, and she's being told that you're not just an actress, you're a vitamin, you're a nutrient, you're a chemical, and everything was translated into everything else. Did you notice that? Anybody in the movie Congress? The
yeah.
Congress? Well, Linda right here is the one who wrote it. You're right here, Linda, right? You're the one who told me to watch it.
Yes.
Right. So that's a McLuhan notion that everything would be convertible into anything else. I think it's called fungibility, fungible. So that's definitely going to be a figure when cold fusion comes in. But I think that's what Ion is teaching people, is how to do that without cold fusion or without any technologies, that you're exchangeable of yourself into anything you want. So here's a bunch of nice words there for you.
All right. Another thing I was going to ask was Roxana had her experience back in March that you guys talked about recently, which is when she heard Ion's voice in her
report
head.
Report to Bob. Didn't you notice on the chat line she
report
does every time
Bob.
She goes out, reporting to Bob. Yeah, she does it all
yeah.
the time.
And. Roxana said that she'd actually had an experience like that when she was much younger.
Here's what I can answer that. If she doesn't want to answer,
yeah.
I think she's still here. Her name is here, but no red marks coming out. She heard all these voices when she was a kid, had some pretty interesting experience. Well, when she was in the gallery last March, the voices came back. I don't think they ever came back much, so it was startling. The voices were back all of a sudden while she's hanging out in the gallery, and then Ion comes in surfing above the voices and starts talking to her. And so that's the retrieval of the voices thing. And she said she spent many years asking people about that experience. Did they have anything similar? It fascinated her. all of a sudden it came back, but Ion was the dominant voice. So that's the only thing I know about her childhood that relates to that gallery experience.
Right. I wanted to ask questions about that experience and other sort of related anomalous experiences that people can expect. Will they come up sort of spontaneously? Will there be some sort of a subtle process of engaging those things, because it came upon Roxana suddenly and sort of caught her off guard.
What did?
And the voices coming back again.
Yeah, that was startling to her to hear them again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the whole feeling that happened when they first happened, it all came back. And then Ian comes in on top of it. So, hey, listen, there's a guy named Scott Woods who is the one I did the dialogue with about Richard Meltzer, who we're trying to get Sandy Perlman to connect us with. He wrote, the first time he's ever written during payday. He said, "Hey, Bob, I just tuned in to Achieve. No idea what I've missed, but here's Burroughs being asked about McLuhan in Rolling Stone, May 1972. Now, he has a great sandbox, what he calls, he has every journalistic mention of McLuhan that ever happened in any context gathered. So I was not aware of this. So he says, so the Rolling Stone interview says, so Mr. Burroughs, you don't feel as McLuhan does that print is on the way out. Now, McLuhan didn't say print was on the way out. He said there'd be more print, because McLuhan changed the meaning of obsolescence. When something's obsolete, you're going to get more of it. And what is actually molding the world is not noticed. It's the 10%. So this question is wrong in the beginning. But anyways, and Burroughs should have known enough about McLuhan to correct the reporter. But he goes, well, no. So he say, no, I do not agree with McLuhan that print is on the way out. What does McLuhan think is going to take its place? We know that physics and mathematics have whole nonverbal communication systems. So then the interviewer says, apparently McLuhan thought electronic media, spoken words and pictures, were going to take the place of print. I mean, that is so silly what the guy is saying. But it was typical of what people thought they were understanding of McLuhan back then. Burroughs says, well, you still have the problem of the actual prose. Now, I see that in this book I'm doing with Malcolm, there are lots of sections which go just like film. In other words, like Ulysses by James Joyce, 50, 60 years before. But the text is really still essential. There are 60 pages of text. We're already having problems with translating that into images. Not the problem that we can't do it, but the problem that it would take 300 pages to do it all. If we took every sentence and translated it into pictures, we'd have a huge book that would be way out of our budget. And there are things, really, that there's no point in translating into pictures, since they are much clearer in prose. There's another point where a page of prose can't do what a picture can. So Burroughs is not very aware. So it reveals how little Burroughs understood about McLuhan, because he would have not got lost in the discussion of the content and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
He wouldn't have known that McLuhan meant that print was on the way out. He just said print. McLuhan said print would not be what he called constitutive. It would not mold people's being. And he says in what we played last week that the 21-year-old, in 66, 67, those over 21 had print before TV. But the younger kids have TV before print, and they're totally different from their older brothers and sisters, as McLuhan knew was the difference between Michael McLuhan, the young kid, versus his older, way older brother, Eric, who was right in McLuhan's family. So anyways, that's thanks, Scott, for pointing this out. Point this out to Brian in a couple weeks, because we really do have Burroughs not knowing what he meant when he said McLuhan was a word analyst. If I was giving him the benefit of the doubt that was a good statement, but the way this is being answered, Burroughs doesn't do well. So he ends up in a bunker in the Bowery with a number 22 on it, and dies.
That supports your whole notion that really nobody got McLuhan except for a handful of people.
Nobody got him. The only people who got him, as I said for years, is the intelligence agencies, because they already were managing a reality on that basis. They already knew, I call it tetrad management, they already knew the meaning was the message, not the content. And that's why it's post, they knew it was post-1984, that you didn't control people's expression. Let them express themselves in any way with any media they have. You do control Walter Cronkite. Walter, which is the only reality, which is an extension of the White House, they will not say there are UFOs. You know, that's what you control, the big picture. But you don't control the extraneous details of life that multimedia people had in the global theater. Let them have anything you want. And that's way more freedom than, okay, so they don't admit to you that the UFOs are real, or they don't say magnesium is important. Well, nowadays you can find out on your own if you're smart, lucky. You don't have to wait till the White House tells you something's happening.
Yeah, and you can create your own
prober. Everybody's got to be an explorer. That's the way you survive today. And you must explore areas you wouldn't even think are relevant, like this fucking show.